Today, we are honored to welcome the 10th Chancellor of the University of Illinois Chicago, Marie Lynn Miranda, who took office in July of 2023. In addition to her role as Chancellor, she is also a faculty member in the Department of Pediatrics and Department of Mathematics, Statistics, and Computer Science. You all wish you were that smart, right? Chancellor Miranda brings a focus of access, equity, and excellence, and a wide range of leadership experiences at Notre Dame, Rice University, and the University of Michigan and Duke University to her role. Are there anyone from one of those schools here represented as well, too? Val's back there. Okay, so we've got good representation from all the schools, right? Dan, sounds like we need to do more with the schools, right? Chancellor Miranda will be in conversation with a great friend, Mr. Michael Fasnacht. Michael is president of Clayco Chicagoland and the first ever chief growth officer. You guys could apply for that. Michael, most recently, as you know, served as CEO of World Business Chicago, and we thank him from this on behalf of the citizens of the city of Chicago for the work that he did. And they also gave him a pretty slamming send-off party, in case you missed it. It was one of those RSVP things, so if you missed it, sorry, I got to go. We're going to start just a tad bit early because we want Michael to be able to get into the meat of the conversation. So I'm going to ask them both to come up now to the podium. And I think there's water and everything for you guys up here. So you all can keep eating, keep, you know, just don't keep talking because we're going to...
So good afternoon. Thank you for being here. And I have to disclose, well, I'm not a journalist, but you have to disclose your biases. And my bias, I'm a huge, huge fan of Chancellor. Yeah. So this will be not an objective conversation. I'm a hype man today, and I will try to do my best to execute that.
Thank you.
You're welcome. So today is a special day.
It's Pi Day.
Oh, yeah.
It is. So tell, why? Because when you called me about it and asked me to join you on stage, you told me, Michael, it's Pi Day. So, and I said, okay. So why are you so excited about Pi Day?
So for those of you who are not aware of this today, you probably know that today is March 14th, but that's 314 or 3.14, which are the first three digits of pi. There are an infinite number of digits of pi. I will not bore you with the number of digits of pi that I know, but I have a bit of a competition with a mathematician friend over the number of digits of pi that we know. And, you know, pi is really, it's just a magical number. There are all kinds of mathematical relationships that have been formed around this number pi, which cannot be reduced because it has an infinite number of digits that go on and on and on and on. So one should celebrate that type of magic in the world.
So now we know why we all have to laugh Pi Day.
Yeah. And also, you have to love Pi Day because somebody might give you a pie.
Ooh. Pi Day. Justice of the Pie, a great baker.
Yeah.
That meant it's not for you, it's for me.
There you go.
So let's start about...
So the lemon cookies are nothing.
No, thank you, thank you. So let's talk about you. So what's your story? What's your story? How did you get here?
Okay, so I grew up in Detroit. And I grew up in the city in Detroit. There are many people who will say that they're from Detroit, but they're from the suburbs. And those of us who are from Detroit figure that out very quickly and reveal them for the frauds that they are. So I grew up in the city in Detroit. I went to school undergrad at Duke. I went to school undergrad at Duke because it was the least expensive place for me to go because they gave me a scholarship, a full scholarship for everything. So it's a funny thing to have ended up at a private institution when I lived in a state with a great public institution. But for our family, given the resources that we had available to us, that's where I went, and it was a great experience for me. I was a math major, so that meant, Dilla, that I hung out with all the cool kids. There were like five math majors, and they were all super cool, I got to tell you. But I had been interested in environmental work for a very long time and knew that I wanted to get a PhD, was interested in the human dimensions of environmental problems, and thought, oh, I should get a PhD in the social sciences. But I couldn't give up my love of mathematics. So I went and got a PhD in the most quantitative or most mathematical of the social sciences, which then and now is economics. So got a PhD in economics, went to Harvard for that. Got my first faculty job back at my alma mater at Duke, and sort of discovered that I had the math, I had the econ, but I really wasn't broadly educated as I wanted to be. So I became self-taught in toxicology, and self-taught well enough that I became a member of the Integrated Toxicology Program faculty. So, so all of that pulled together provided me with the skills and tools that were necessary to do sort of serious quantitative work around children's environmental health. So I'm the director of something called the Children's Environmental Health Initiative, which has moved with us here to the University of Illinois, Chicago. And I've had leadership positions, as Jackie pointed out, at a number of places. But also, that's like what I've done, who I am, is that I'm married to the love of my life, we've been married for 33 years. This summer will be 34 years. So that is worth applause. I have three children. I have two English setters, and I have roughly 400,000 honeybees.
I think you're famous for, because whenever people are doing something kind for you, you give them a gift of honey.
Yes.
And I can tell you, this is amazing honey. I was able to get it once.
Yeah. Well, I was going to give you honey today, but it's pie day, my friend.
Yeah, that's true. So let's go back to your upbringing. Anything, because most of us have one or two things that kind of shape us based on the family, the context we grew up. What has been the one or two things that really shaped who you are today?
Yeah. So I grew up in a big, crowded, noisy immigrant family. So when I was growing up, it was my mother, my father, my three brothers, myself, my grandmother, her two sisters, my cousin, his wife, and his three kids. We lived together. We ate meals together every day. My cousin and his wife weren't there the whole time, but the rest of that crowd was there. And I got a couple of things out of that. Number one, I developed the ability to work under any conditions. It doesn't matter how loud it was or how little space you had at the table, like a little praying mantis, I could still do my, do my work. So no matter what the ambient conditions were, I developed that. And I also grew up knowing in my deepest core, at my very core, I grew up knowing that I was deeply loved. Mm-hmm. And I have three brothers, and if I don't know how many people would say this, but if I could pick any three men in the world to be my brothers, I would pick the three brothers that I have. So that's the tightness of our family. And then the other thing that I would say is, so when I was in elementary school, I got sent to the principal's office a lot. And
because you taught the principal of math, I assume.
No. But there was the assistant to the principal who sort of intervened on my behalf, and she had formerly been the librarian at the school. And she told the principal that she had this idea. And the idea was that whenever I really felt the need to be somewhere besides the classroom, that I could go to the library. And she taught me the organization of the library, where all of the different books were. She actually pointed out where all of the books about the outdoors and wildlife. I read Jack London for the first time because of her, and that's where my interest in the environment began. Right by my house in Detroit, maybe three or four blocks away, there was the branch of the Detroit Public Library. So really early on, because of this wonderful intervention by Mrs. Immergluck, still remember her.
Germany.
Because of this wonderful intervention from Mrs. Immerglück, I developed this deep love of the library and deep love of this idea that if you were curious about something, you could learn about it. The public libraries meant that there wasn't a barrier between me and what I wanted to learn. The resources of my family was that didn't throw anything up between me and my ability to get into the library and learn about what I wanted to learn about. So those two things, having this knowing that I was deeply loved and early on being taught that whatever you're curious about, there are ways to fuel that curiosity that are available to you no matter what the circumstances you find yourself in.
What a powerful story of the importance of teachers and libraries. And we have Brenda here from the Library Foundation, I think is so important. So it's good to have city council members here as well who are funding these organizations to make sure we keep it going. So if we look at your life, it looks like a life full of accomplishments. And we also want to talk about, so if you look back, what are maybe also one or two of the disappointments you had in your career? Mm-hmm. Also like one or two biggest successes.
Yeah. You know, I find, it's a common interview question, right? Like, hey, you talked about your successes. Tell us about your failures. And I actually think that for every success that you have eventually, there are a whole series of failures along the way. And the question is whether or not you're able, after a failure, to pick yourself up and rethink the path, figure out another way forward, and also whether or not you're smart enough and have enough humility to periodically say, I need to abandon this. It's not working. So my research group, in the research realm, we're probably best known for the work that we did to help get the national standard on the CDC's national standard on childhood blood lead levels changed. It was, for a very long time, it was at 10 micrograms per deciliter. Our group did a lot of work that showed that there were effects at much lower levels. There were a lot of attempts to get that policy changed, and eventually it was changed, and right now it's gone from 10 to 2.5. But it took 11 years of work to go from 10 to 5. So 11 years before there was any impact on the national policy. And there were various attempts to bring the research, to have a communication strategy, all of that, that failed and failed and failed until they succeeded. Right? And the movement from 5 to 2.5 was much easier because we figured out when you had and it wasn't just our group, there was many groups, we figured out what the sources of the failures along the way were, and we adjusted the way that we worked. So another example, COVID. So I was at Notre Dame, led the academic part of the response to COVID, which meant getting the classes taught and getting the students through their learning objectives and getting them to graduation and all those sorts of things. And Notre Dame finished the year with having held in-person classes the entire year. And that feels like a big success. But along the way, there were, in the first couple weeks of classes, there was a huge spike in cases. We had to flip all of our teaching to online, essentially lock our students in the dormitory. And were it not for the technology, I will mention it, boss, were it not for the technology from the University of Illinois that we adopted, I'm not sure that we would have been able to recover. Right?
Thank you.
So we were able to recover, and we stayed in person. But still, when I look back on that year, we had 3,500 cases of COVID on our campus. And there were other campuses that held in-person classes that had much lower caseloads than we do. So I think a lot about what we could have and should have done differently. So That success feels like it had a whole series of failures attached to it. And even our work with lead, that success feels like there was a whole series of failures. And part of your character is how you respond when things aren't easy. Mm-hmm. But, you know, if everything's easy, life isn't very interesting.
Doing great things are mostly always difficult and challenging. Yeah. But it's like that you called out your boss, President Killeen, who, by the way, just got his contract renewed. So we're fortunate enough to have him again for a few more years. He's a great man. So clearly we can feel you're an amazing, engaging teacher. Why decide then to go into like almost like a CEO role, which is called academic leadership?
Yeah.
Well, why?
So first of all, I want to thank you for calling it academic leadership and not academic administration. Nobody says to Torrance Hinton, oh, I hear you're in administration. You know, nobody
it's
says that leadership. To you. It's
especially in today's
right?
world, yeah. It's leadership.
So, first of all, I never thought I was going to go into academia at all. I was bound to determine when I was finishing up my PhD that I was going to, I was going to work overseas on a variety of different sustainability projects, and I was not going to go into academia. And I had I was so terrible. I would say things like, "I'm going to get a real job," but I had this my dissertation advisor, Peter Timmer, he would say to me all the time, you know, of all the students I've mentored, you belong in the academy. And I would say to him, Peter, you're projecting. You know, you're great in the academy, but this is not my place. I'm telling you I'm going to go elsewhere. And my last year of graduate school, I was offered the opportunity to teach a class, not be the TA, but to teach it on my own. And I didn't need the money because I had a fellowship. But Peter asked me, as a favor to him, would I teach the class? And given the way that I was raised in that immigrant family that had very particular views on how you treated people who mentored you and who were your elders and who should be respected, I said yes. So I'm teaching this class, and I'm 2/3 of the way through the first class session, and I think to myself, man, Peter was right. I love the classroom. I love the community that you try to create in the classroom. I love the relationship, the intellectual, the professional, the personal relationships the students are developing amongst themselves that you're trying to develop with them. I love watching their minds light on fire when an idea really catches fire for them. So that's how I ended up in academia. How I ended up in academic leadership I found myself thinking about, you know, when you're a professor, your job is to take your individual ideas and try, whether those are ideas about the classroom or about your research, and try to move those ideas forward. When you're in a leadership position, you have this amazing opportunity to look around the room and see, and look around whatever organization you're leading and see what all of their ideas are, and see what some of the connections might be across their ideas, even though they're not talking to each other. And you get to move a whole suite of people's ideas forward, and the potential for impact, whether those are ideas about innovations and how we teach, or ideas about a new tack on a research program, moving all of those ideas forward, the impact that you can have just scales in an enormous way. And so I was very interested in having the opportunity to create programs that truly supported student success for all of our students, not just our students who came in with a lot of privilege. And I was very interested in, as a researcher myself, I knew what some of the barriers and some of the problems were with the systems that surrounded me. I was very interested not in telling this faculty member, you work on this, or this faculty member, you work on this, but seeing what the barriers were to their best ideas moving forward and freeing them from their barriers so that their work could just take flight. So that's how I ended up in leadership.
And now, clearly you had a lot of options when you decided, what do I do next? And you chose us. You chose Chicago and you chose UIC. Why?
You have to open it for the water to come out, it turns out. I'm sorry.
Yeah, it's a very fancy Yeti cup, yeah.
Yep, Yep, it's you I see red.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah. So, first of all, why UIC? So, in my industry, in the industry of higher education, it's very clear what we're all supposed to want. We're all supposed to want to be the number one or the number two at a top 20 institution, preferably a private institution, and preferably one with a big endowment. And that's what I had. I was the number two at Notre Dame. And I think what COVID did for a lot of us was have us really deeply reflect on how we want to spend our time, what feels worthwhile to us, what feels meaningful to us. And what I grew increasingly to understand is that I wanted to be able to spend 90% of my time on the things that were most important to me rather than 10% of my time on that. And the things that were most important to me were all about how do we provide opportunities to underserved communities? How do we provide health care to underserved communities? How do we provide oral health care to underserved communities? How do we support research projects which are designed to support the goals and hopes and aspiration of communities that are typically not paid attention to very much? And that thing that my industry tells me I'm supposed to want was not giving me what I knew in my heart I really wanted. And so then this, you know, UIC opportunity presented itself. And, I mean, what is not to love about UIC? If you look at its mission, you know, our mission is to provide the broadest access to the highest levels of educational research and clinical excellence. There are many places that have a lot of access. There are places, I don't know how many there are. There are places that have a lot of access. There are places that have the excellence in the other areas. There are very few places that say access and excellence go together. We're going to make both of those things happen. So the opportunity to come to UIC, the university was great, and it's in Chicago. I mean, what's not to love about Chicago? So, I'm from Detroit, so Chicago has kind of a familiar feel to me. But the food here is fantastic. Notice that's the first thing I mentioned. Yeah. The food here is fantastic. I love jazz, and I've been going to the Chicago Symphony Orchestra's jazz series. So the food is great here. The music is great here. It's a walkable city. I barely ever drive my car. I walk to work. I walk to the grocery store. And you know what? People are nice here. Midwestern nice is a real thing. I'm from the Midwest. I've always believed it was a real thing. But you come to this big, complicated, somewhat confusing city, and you have to figure it all out. And you ask questions, and people help you. People are not trying to elbow you out of the way. They help you to understand this place. So I love my job. I love the University of Illinois Chicago, and I love the fact that it's in Chicago. I love being a resident of this great city.
It's great. So we clearly have to talk with the governor and the mayor to give you a speaking role at the DNC convention to promote our city. So, UIC, what are the two or three strategic initiatives that we should know about, that you're bringing the next 3 or 5 years to further elevate this organization, institution, about access and excellence? What are two or three things we should know?
Okay. So some of you from the university have unfortunately heard me say this several times, but I always say there are just two things you need to remember about UIC. The first one is that we are all about access. And we prove that by the fact that 56% of our undergraduate students are Pell Grant recipients, 46% of our undergraduate students are first-gen students. Our clinics are very deeply focused on serving communities, serving underserved communities. And we're a minority-serving institution, a Hispanic-serving institution, an Asian-American, Native American, Pacific Islander-serving institution. So we're all about access, the first thing you need to remember. The second thing you need to remember is that we have a $500 million research program. So what that means is that our faculty are competing their ideas nationally and internationally and winning. So what that means is that our faculty are at UAC not because they can't get a job anywhere else. They're at UAC because they love UAC the way that I do. They love the mission that we have to serve those students in the classroom and to serve those patients in the clinic and to engage with the communities across Chicagoland. They love that as much as I do. So just remember, we're all about access, and we have a $500 million research program. And if you remember that, you've got the essence of UIC in just two small sentences.
You probably created no more applications, I think.
For I hope so. I hope so.
So let's move to maybe some of the challenging topics that any university president is facing right now on campus. First is the
Are there challenging things?
I think I admire that because I think you're doing a service for our community, for the nation, as being an academic leader here. The Middle East, the conflict in the Middle East. We talked about this before today. How do you think about this? How do you deal with the tensions of free speech, with strong emotions around this topic? How do you approach such a complicated topic?
Okay. The first thing that I want to say is that campuses are not on fire. Okay, if you read the newspaper and you watch the news, you have this impression that campuses are not on fire. I must have armed guards who are escorting me from one building to another. As I said, I walk everywhere across campus, back and forth to my apartment. Most of the time, what you see is students are going to class, faculty are doing their research. Students are working together on problem sets, and they're working together across all kinds of different racial, ethnic, and religious groups. So campuses are not on fire, and I want everybody to remember that, if you remember one thing from this topic, from this talk. So if you will allow me to just be Professor Miranda for a minute, I just want to talk a little bit about free speech, academic freedom, Title VI. So the First Amendment to the Constitution says that the government, we're a public institution, that means that we're the government, the government cannot censor or otherwise punish an individual merely for the act of expressing an idea or a viewpoint. That's what the First Amendment says. I'm sure there are lawyers in this room, and now I'm becoming a little bit nervous about me explaining the First Amendment to a room. But you can feel free to correct me.
Yeah.
So the First Amendment says that, right? So then we hear a lot of talk about academic freedom. The First Amendment applies to everyone. Academic freedom does not apply to everyone. It only applies to faculty. It doesn't apply to students. It doesn't apply to staff. Academic freedom applies to faculty, and it only applies to them in their role and expertise as scholars and teachers. And academic freedom comes along with a bundle of responsibilities that have to do with professional standards, ethical behavior, all of those sorts of things. So there's free speech, there's academic freedom. You hear this is written about a lot in the newspapers. But actually, the nexus of the issues that are bubbling up on campuses is less about free speech and academic freedom and more about Title VI of the Civil Rights Act. So Title VI of the Civil Rights Act says, I'm not going to get this language quite right, that Title VI says that you cannot intentionally harass or otherwise cause harm to people on the basis of race, color, or national origin. And what the Department of Education says is that if there are things that are said and done on your campus, you have an obligation to respond. And if you are not in compliance with Title VI, we can remove all of your federal funding. So that's a big stick that the Department of Education has. But the problem that universities find themselves in is that the Department of Education is saying, if you fail to respond to, if you fail to act, we can do all these things to you and we will do all these things to you. But that's even if what you're failing to respond to and what you're failing to act on is constitutionally protected free speech. So the First Amendment is telling us one thing. The Department of Education in Title VI is telling us another thing, which creates kind of an impossible position if you're in the academy. Now, that's okay, because just because it's a very difficult position doesn't mean you shouldn't think hard and try to figure out what you should do next. So what universities have done, including my own and the others in the University of Illinois system and many universities across the country, have created these things called bias response teams. They're not sanctioning teams. They're not punitive teams. They don't go out punishing people. But they go out and have conversations and say, tell me about, you reported this. Tell me about what happened. Let me go talk to this other person. Let's see if we can get a conversation going. They're meant to be a process of education, right? So that seemed like, okay, now we had a way of reconciling this conflict. But then it gets better. Then an organization called Speech First found a series of student litigants in six different states to make the argument that the very existence of the bias response teams served to chill their speech and therefore abrogated their free speech rights. And there have been six cases. The case law is mixed on this, but all of this means that we're still back in this dilemma. So again, we're in this dilemma. Universities of all places should be good at figuring out what to do facing these dilemmas. So our job is not to sort out all of the legal quagmire that the country finds itself in, although our law school could help with that. Our job is to help our faculty, staff, and students learn how to engage in conversations, even when we are, or engage ideas, if you will, engage ideas that we disagree with, that we find hateful, that we find odious. That our job is to help people figure out how to engage in those conversations around those topics. And our job is to help, especially our students, figure out how can you have conversations with people with whom you disagree? How can you have dialogues across difference, right? And so we have a whole series of programs that are all about creating opportunities for members of our community to have these dialogues across difference. And I would venture to guess that most of the employers in this room would love to have employees who were skilled at being able to talk across difference. So in the academy, that's one of the things that we're focusing on. And we talk about the fact that just because you have the right that the First Amendment gives you to say something, does it make it a good idea to say that? You know, does that constitute effective communication? Does that help you build the community that you're embedded in? And all of us are building community, right? Whether you're building community in your organization or in your company or in your neighborhood, we're all building community. So getting on our campus, we have a special opportunity to get people to think about how can we use our rights in this democracy, and democracy is such a precious and fragile institution. How can we use our rights in this democracy to build it, to reinforce the democracy, to make our communities stronger, to make our city and our region and our state stronger? So,
thank you for this very important, I think, answer. True academic leadership. So,
not too professorial.
No. I think it's important because sometimes we get asked in like with two or three words answers. Yeah. This is a complicated topic, and I think you've shown true leadership with the answer.
Can I say one other thing?
Not really.
Please.
Just kidding.
So, when people keep saying like, "Oh, it must be a hard job," I'm like, "Are you kidding me? I get to work every day with this incredible group of students, faculty, and staff who are deeply committed to our mission. I get to be part of delivering an education that transforms students, their families for generations. I get to be part of supporting researchers who are changing the world every day and creating reasons for hope. I get to be part of making sure that every Chicagoan, every Illinoisan, and people across the world, regardless of their privilege, have access to health care. I have peregrine falcons that nest outside my window.
You really like this. You told me about that. Yeah, chasing.
You know, like, I think I have the best job in Chicago.
Did you hear that? I love that. Thank you. I know we had a lot of other questions prepared, but one more question that I know is close for both of us and important before we open up for the guests here is right now you see nationwide challenges on diversity, equity, inclusion programs on campus. Why are these programs and initiatives still as important as 10 or 20 years ago?
Yeah. So I think this is one of these places where when some people think about diversity, equity, and inclusion, they have in their mind programs that provide preferential treatment in the admissions process for particular groups. And they have in mind sort of punitive policing of speech, right? And we don't use race in admissions at UIC. We haven't used it I don't know how long it's been since we've used it. We recruit excellent students who are well aligned with our mission, and that has resulted in one of the most diverse college campuses in the country. So we, I mentioned earlier MSI, HSI, ANAPESI, all the acronyms, right? So we don't use race in admissions, and we're really not interested in punitive policing of speech. What we are interested in making sure is that when we have that diverse group of students come to us, it's not enough to admit them. You have to retain them. You have to get them to graduation. You have to get them placed into a good job. And you have to give them a sense that they really belong at that institution, right, all along the way. And if you want to do that for the entire student body, you have to pay attention to the differences in experiences and the differences in educational background that are just true in our country, right? So our diversity programs are all about looking at the differing needs of different members of our student population, our faculty and staff population, and making sure that we're creating an environment where they can thrive. And all of that is aimed at increasing our graduation rates, decreasing disparities in outcomes, and ensuring that people feel that UIC is a place for them, that they can be there and thrive and prosper. So you have a diverse class, you don't get the benefits of diversity by osmosis, right? If I'm walking down the sidewalk with Dilla, I'm not suddenly going to become cool, right? By a process of, and I know that you are much more than cool, my friend. By a process of osmosis, right? I actually have to engage with people if I'm going to benefit from the diversity on our campus. And that's the other thing that our diversity programs are doing, are providing spaces and places and venues and courses and all of those things where the benefits that are well established in the literature of diversity can come alive on our campus. So that's why diversity programs are still necessary, because we're a diverse country, but we're not fully leveraging all the richness that the diversity of this country could give us in terms of our economic productivity, our social happiness, our relationships with each other, and our relationships globally.
So hopefully you all have seen why I'm such a big fan of Chancellor Miranda. Thoughtful, passionate. We're just lucky to have you. Did you choose us to make Chicago your home? And so when you see her on the street, so don't be shy. Talk with her. You know, ask for like a recommendation for your children to get in. It always works. Trust me. You might even get on a lucky day some honey from her. Okay. But now we'd open up Dan for any questions on the guest today.
If you have questions, there are some sheets on your tables.
I should have 10 hours.
Thank you, Michael, for asking the tough questions. If anyone does have questions, just raise your hand or just move them on up, and we will and we'll be sure to ask them in close.
Stratmon is clearly
Strat.
Yeah. We rarely allow this, but Michael Stratmon, you as an Ignatian, I know you're not going to put us too much on the spot.
Just a little, because one of the conversations in Chicago right now. In particular, but around the country, are about our new arrivals who are here. And I think that, you know, in so many ways, one of the things that's important about Chicago is that we have been a place for new arrivals. You know, I have a family that arrived here from the South fleeing terror, and I have a family that arrived here from Eastern Europe fleeing terror. And I wonder, considering the reputation and the skill set of your university of being a place that is there for new arrivals to get integrated into our city, how are you thinking about both the opportunity and the challenges that we're facing right now?
Yeah, so my family is immigrant. We were not fleeing terror. We came to this country because of the educational opportunities for that were made available to my father. So I can't pretend to understand at a molecular level the experience of the refugees that have most recently arrived. But the whole idea of coming to this country sight unseen, trying to, you know, find your way, I have some understanding of that. I mean, what I would say is if you come to our campus is full of immigrants. It's full of people who speak multiple languages. And it's full of people who have had those kinds of experiences. That means that we have to make sure that our faculty are educated around what it is to have students like that in our classrooms. It also means that, frankly, our mental health services have to be trauma-informed services, have to be thinking about the global issues that may be impacting our students. There, clearly, the conflict in the Middle East has a very deep impact on multiple groups in our student body. Our Palestinian students are, you know, the level of pain that I see on a daily basis is really, it's heartbreaking. And I see that pain amongst our Jewish students also, right? So in terms of, you know, we welcome immigrants into the, you know, into our university, we also have a whole series of faculty who are engaged in communities doing work. I know that Dr. Radosta, John Radosta, who's our chief medical officer, there's been a measles outbreak at the Pilsen Refugee Center, and our docs and nurses have been down there taking care of kids and getting people immunized. We have faculty from multiple departments who are engaged with the city. We're trying to provide, this felt small, but nevertheless, we provided space for the processing of paperwork so that people, you know, as people arrived, there was a way for all that, a place for all that paperwork to get processed. We have a lot of students who are bilingual, so those students are playing a critical role. So we see the university, if you look at a university faculty, it's full of people from all over the world, and we think that's great. We see the arrival of these refugees as we feel an obligation. We feel an obligation to commit to engaging, and we've tried to do that in the ways that make sense given our expertise. There are some things we can't do particularly well. And we're also, you know, what I would say is that it's so important to remember that behind those numbers, like the last time I checked the numbers, it was 33,000. It's probably much larger than that right now, but it's not 33,000. Like I'm a mathematician, statistician, right? So 33,000 is a fact. It's a little cold, right? It's 33,000 individual people, it's mothers and fathers and their children who, you know, have had an incredible set of traumatic experiences, including after they entered our country, right? So remembering that as we, you know, as we walk around and are encountering the refugee population, remembering to greet them with warmth and with a smile and with love, bring love to that situation, because it's inexcusable to bring anything but love to a community of individuals who have gone through all the things that they've gone through.
Thank you for that. Thank you, and thanks for the question, Mike. I have a quick one, and I do think, as Michael said, it's been great to hear about how you got to this place in your career and of course, in your life and all the folks that have benefited from that journey along the way. I'm just excited that it brought you here to Chicago. So I think we got a few people in the room that might agree with me. So you, in the few months you've been here, you've been such a welcome addition to Chicago's civic community. I actually just texted a friend of mine, Mickey Kidder at Notre Dame. I said Notre Dame's loss is Chicago's gain. So thank you. But really, in the few months you've been here, what have you seen about Chicago's civic community and the role of the university and you as the leader of that university in the larger civic community? And maybe compare it to other cities or just what you've seen about Chicago's civic community as we have so many of those leaders gathered here today.
You know, what's really striking to me in Chicago, at different points in time, I felt like I saw this in Detroit, in particular when Detroit was about to go into bankruptcy. You saw this happen. But in Chicago, even before such a crisis as bankruptcy, what I see is corporate leaders, philanthropic leaders, nonprofit organization leaders, people from the city government and from the state government, thinking, you know, truly thinking, we're better together. We're better when we're collaborating. And what gets better is the city and Chicagoland and the state get better. And so there's this openness to thinking broadly and to not sort of say, well, you know, here's this little part that I'm going to work on and you guys stay out of it. And there's this attitude of we're all here to make this city a yet more strong and amazing place. And when we do that, all of us are uplifted. The public schools are uplifted. The libraries are uplifted. The workforce is uplifted. I mean, at UIC, we take seriously the idea that we are training Chicago's workforce, right? So that's part of our civic engagement around all of this. So I just love the fact that there is actually civic life. There is actually this notion that we should be working together as a larger community. And I don't think you see that in every city. I haven't seen it. I certainly haven't seen it in all the cities that I've lived in. So,
great. We might use that clip if you don't mind. That's great. So many, so well aligned with so many folks in this room and City Club, of course, to hear that from you. Look at who's here, and there are others. I know there are members of the Board of Trustees of the university system and of UIC. Please raise your hand if you're here. We have other universities present. I know Phil Hale is here from Loyola. Jackie mentioned so many incredible civic leaders, and so neat to hear your story and, of course, your insights into some of these pressing issues. As I said, you're such a welcome addition here, and Chancellor, we look forward to so much more to come.
Thank you.
Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me. It's a privilege.
You're welcome back. Thank you. You're welcome back anytime. And as I said to President Killeen, we have a couple of other ideas for some programs in the future. So we hope you'll all be back here very soon. And on that note, Jackie mentioned on Monday we have the President MacArthur Foundation and the president of the Chicago Community Trust in conversation with our own Dion Dawson, one of our favorites. There are maybe five or six seats, so please check in on the way out or check the website. And then we've got so many great programs coming. COPA and civilian oversight of the police department. We've got there's about three or four in April that we have in the books that you'll see soon. So please come back. We won't always have Michael Fosnock, but what a treat to have him here today. World Business Chicago's loss is, of course, Clayco's gain. As long as you stay committed to Chicago's civic scene, we're all better off. Chancellor, good luck in the coming weeks. We know you have your investiture. It's an exciting time for you.
Thank you.
And, again, welcome back, all of you, to City Club. Excuse me. We hope to see you all soon and appreciate everybody's time today. Thank you.
Thank you.